You're listening to St. Pete X. Today's episode is brought to you by Cityverse. Cityverse brings the community together on a new civic platform powered by Catalyst News. St. Pete Cityverse is launching soon. You can learn more and reserve your home space at cityverse.life. Now, enjoy the conversation. Joining me today is the recently retired but still active Carl Lavender. Welcome.
Joe, good to see you as always and proud of your work and accomplishments. Good to see you are still the catalyst for change in our community.
Trying my best, following in great footsteps.
I'm flattered. Keep it coming.
We will. I'll pepper them in. So one thing I think is really unique about your career, and you've been serving people since basically you were a child, you following your father's footsteps as a pastor, and it has just been in you since day one, pretty much. Is that a fair assessment?
I think it's a fair assessment. I was raised, if they call a PK, preacher's kid, and my father in Cleveland, Ohio, was an evangelist. And so our house became a house full of people in transition in their faith journey. And I'm grateful for that because he was my role model and my hero. And to this day, my own faith journey is deeply based upon how my father navigated his family and represented us and taught and led. He became the pastor of a storefront church in the beginning, which grew to a sizable congregation. I watched that journey and was inspired by that for my own life and how you build small and gradually get larger and larger and larger, if it is supposed to be, and how you handle both difficult people and wonderful people. So he was a terrific role model for me. And so it's a childhood that, for all accounts, I don't regret it all.
Wonderful. And when you witnessed him, you know, through your, you know, younger years up to your adolescence, working with his constituents and with families, probably seeing all manner of highs and lows, you know, how would you articulate how that felt and what you saw in him doing that?
Well, first and foremost, he was absolutely the friendliest person you'd ever want to meet. The old adage, he knew no strangers. My father just spoke to everyone. And he was captivating in the sense of he's the kind of person in a grocery store. He holds a conversation. He's talking to people and someone overhears it. And suddenly he has a few people all listening to him speak. He was just that kind of charisma. And so watching that happen and how he dismantled the moment, because you can't stand in the grocery store all day. But I watched how he would wrap it up and how he would begin following through, et cetera. So it was just that kind of inspiration, but also smart strategy that I remember most about him. Now, I will tell you, his self-care wasn't as good. I think the self-care movement has come into prominence in the last 15, 20 years of our own adult lives. Back in his day, self-care wasn't as big a conversation. As a matter of fact, the workaholic, regardless of the industry, was a badge of honor.
Right.
And so I watched him work himself into a heart attack, and he died. But at the end of the day, I remember that very clearly. And so for my own life, pacing it the way I do, I've had my own health issues, but I'm pacing my life, learning when to take a break, learning when to advance, being short term if necessary, like with the city, or being long term, like I did with the Boys and Girls Clubs. Sort of deciding to manage my life in that way is an important part of who I am. Lessons learned from my father and my mother, who was this incredible earth woman, who was grounded, deeply grounded in family and good character and strong character, was a big part of her teaching us. So you take his faith journey with my mother's, have a good character, be known as a good person, show up on time, do your job, go to work, engage yourself. All of those things were, so I had a good solid combination between the two of them.
Yeah, it seems like it's the curse and the blessing of opportunity. When you meet no stranger, every person is an opportunity.
Yes.
And especially if you go beyond just the surface and you actually do follow through, as you said that he did, then, you know, that digs in even deeper and presents more work.
So my mother became the gatekeeper.
Right.
Because my father would come home and literally in his stream of consciousness, there were episodes of courts during the day, he'd bring those into the family. And she was the one that brought the discipline that says, leave that in the car or leave that where it was. You got things to do here in the place and honey-do lists, as we refer to them sometimes. But mostly your children need to have you a part of their moment, you know. So it was tough sometimes because my father, being a pastor, would oftentimes speak in pastoral cadence, you know, pass the potato, turn the channel on the television. It was that kind of thing. She would go reminding him, you are at home, please.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you calm that down?
Mom wasn't having
normal,
it.
Yes, she was. Normal conversation here, please. You know, these are your children. So it was pleasant, comical, but also very purposed.
So when people are, you know, that extroverted and high energy, when you're developing, sometimes it doesn't leave a lot of space, even if your tendency might be to be extroverted. So did you feel that extroversion and that ability to perform and do good on demand wherever you turn, did you see that as a pressure? Did you see it as an aspirational thing? Or how did that resonate with you?
That's a good question. It's a combination. You know, believe it or not, I have an introvert nature. People often, what? Yes, I do. I do. I have an introvert nature. And so part of me was, yes, I see the pressure to be in the moment and to deliver on cause, whatever that may be. You know, I oftentimes say when you're at the microphone and the audience is all looking at you, they're ready to hear something from you. So there is pressure in that moment, not just to be articulate, although there are times when that can be overstated, but to be purposed and leading and inspiring can be some pressure. But I internalize that and think about my father and how I watched him over the years from a very small congregation of people at a storefront, as I told you earlier, just saying, to one where there is a throng of folks. He just knew how to navigate that. And so, yes, there's the pressure there. But then that's also, I have found a way to detox, if you will, if I could use that word. When the time is over, I'm not especially excited. I will do it. Not always about working the room when the event is over. I have a very, very dear friend in Chicago who says you get there first and you're the last to leave. That was her methodology, and she's very, very, very successful. But I could not do that last to leave. When I'm finished speaking or presenting or panelizing, give me 15 minutes. I'm really ready to get out of there, to get to my car, exhale, and resume my energy, the energy that I brought to the table. So my father had, as I said earlier, had a challenge with that. But I've learned over time to do that best. That's good for me. It just works for me.
And you know, this is, will foreshadow a little bit of your next steps in Chicago, but how do you remember your father dealing with the financial elements of running a church? You know, obviously it's always an interesting element because, you know, the way you inspire and move people leads to tithing and has a direct impact, but it's such a, you know, you feel sort of separate to that. So how did he marry those two worlds?
You know, the scripture that says 5 loaves and 2 fishes, how the people were fed, 5,000 were fed. So the modesty point of view is an important way of managing sometimes meager resources. I know in my lifetime that I've out-earned my dad. He probably would be amazed at the wage and salary plan that I've had over the last 10 years. I know that he would be. But I watched how he would, in fact, stretch a dollar, because that brother could stretch a dollar. And so could my mom even further. So I watched that. I have not always been the best, but I make every attempt to teach myself and my children to be very responsible with their dollars, because it is a blessing and a privilege to have this kind of thing.
So he wasn't you didn't see him putting a lot of energy into optimizing revenue. He put most of his energy into saving and being frugal so he wouldn't have to go heavier for money.
Bought a home, took us out of the inner city, bought a home, nice house. Yes, he was very much intentional in that regard. My father was especially good at leveraging relationships beyond the initial ask. You know, on Sunday mornings, it is, as they say in business, the single largest bank deposits in America are made on Monday morning when churches all go to churches and banks and deposit. Well, my father made that happen, but also made sure that at the end of the day, there was a real sense of obligation to how we do in the house, and that this is the clothes you will wear, et cetera. And during my teen years, there was some rebellion. You know, it's peer pressure on that regard. You know, you're the preacher's kid. You got to wear the hand-me-downs kind of thing. But he understood that. But he also taught the lesson about that. On the one hand, yes, I understand I don't have much, but you must learn how to deal with little. And if you learn how to deal with little, you'll appreciate a lot. And so I realized that in my childhood. And so, but again, there were some challenges. And what's interesting in this boomer journey, which many of us boomers have this point of view, well, when I get mine, I'm going to do this, 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 and this, and this. And I have done that. You know, I can remember having the bowl of cereal shared with everybody. You know, and I said, when I have children, you get your own cereal. Everybody had their own box.
Right, right.
You know, and my father would visit us. And my family would go, what? Everybody has their own. Yes, each child likes their own cereal. I can go on and get, you know, as opposed to the one bowl. So it was that kind of, but in many ways, Joe, that was the typical of boomers, was to be able to have that happen. So it's in keeping with that thread.
You didn't have Publix BOGO back then either, right?
No, we had A&P in Cleveland. It was A&P when every bag or grocery item was black and white. The letters were black and it was all over our cabinet. And I said to myself, when I get my house, I want a box with the brand on it and all of those things that I bought when I had my first apartment. I went to the store and, oh my gosh, going to the deli, it became an experience, but wonderful memories.
So when you have the inevitable rebellious phase, and obviously your position or your father's position impacted your social life as well as, you know, part of your identity, how severe was that to go through? And then did any of the things that you rebelled against stick? You know, did any of them sort of stay, or did they just kind of come and go?
I think come and go. You try to find a pathway that will allow you some growth. You try to identify with people and relationships and systems that allow you to grow. Even though I can be a maverick at times, and that side of me will show up in culture. I know it bothers people, you know, sometimes, but it's meant to be good for me and those around me. And that's important, that there be some growth going on and that I can sit back and measure that, Joe, that I can say that I'm growing in this role. We have new ideas and concepts that are coming to life and people are benefiting from it. And we've raised the bar. There's new narrative and new language and new study and new research because of what we're doing together. That to me is important, very important. So yes, my maverick plug, being uncomfortable at times, is only because we can become stale and complacent and predictable. And that is not how I think. And I think that in today's age of science and creative thinking, that kind of thing may maintain a status quo, but it really is time for a whole lot more people that are visionaries enough to shake up and make some new things happen.
Wonderful. So then I was going to ask you, I mean, you kind of answered it, but when is it appropriate to be a maverick? Like what are the situations you've, if there's best practices for all things, yes. When do you deviate?
Yes. For me, it's sitting in the room full of bureaucrats and, you know, sort of asking the question. I think when you read data, for example, and you see the obvious, that there's a real serious challenge here, for example, there's a challenge in some data of our community. And people approach it like a 9-to-5. We read the data, you respond politely. But there isn't the sense of a dramatic leap forward to engage multiple systems leaders, et cetera, in problem solving. That's when a maverick side would say, this doesn't work, folks. And here's the reasons why. It may rub against culture. It may rub against status quo. But there needs to be some big steps forward here. There's a community that needs us. And so I am very much interested in moving that forward. And I can be a little uncomfortable to some people at that time.
So basically, you probably have some variation of those observations in all situations. You just have to decide when the risk is worth the reward to go maverick.
Yes. Well, consequentially, there can be some people who resist it and their politic will surface. And so you may have a great entry into the culture, but then on your way out, people are like, oh, I'm glad to see him go. At the end of the day, this sort of, you know, there is this moment when you realize, okay, I have hit up against the brick wall, and that wall is tight and it turns against what I'm trying to accomplish, and you can become uncomfortable for everybody. And that's when you decide, you know, I've done the best that I can. But my leave behind would be what I tried to do, introduce new ideas and concepts, et cetera. And a person more comfortable with managing that space going forward inside culture can take it and run with it. I've done that many times in my career.
Wonderful. So you moved after growing up in Ohio, your sort of professional blooming happened in Chicago.
You know me too well, Joe. Oh my gosh.
So talk about that time and sort of the transformation you underwent in the big city.
I had a mentor that did a terrific job of giving me counsel. You know, so you sort of reach, you sort of plateau in Columbus, Ohio, where I was. I had done some things. I was proud of the work that I was doing. And then you look at your cash flow. You know, you're looking, okay, this is not going to grow. I've got children. And so talking to a mentor, he said, well, you got to get out of the market that you're in. This small Midwest town at the time, not like today, it's a major player. But at the time, several decades ago, it was not the market that was drawing big capital in philanthropy and in the industry that I'm in. So he said, try for some bigger cities and bigger markets. So I tried to go to Detroit. I interviewed in Detroit and lost out to a homegrown candidate in the Detroit area, who I know very, very well and is beloved in our country, and went on to Chicago. And there I was picked up by the organization, the Boys and Girls Clubs of Chicago, to be the director for their Dr. King Club on the west side of Chicago. Now, you're coming out of Columbus, Ohio, to the west side of Chicago. I mean, it's a culture shock. And there are lots of problems. There was a gang war going on around our building. And a lot of it required of me both energy and expertise that I had not cultivated in Columbus. And that's when I called to thank my mentor, because now you're pushing me up the ladder to test who I am, test my capacity and my resourcefulness. I learned so much in Chicago. I give it 100% credit for the professional and the person that I am today. It was true. I got promoted several times. When I left Chicago, I left as the senior vice president for, at the time, the largest Boys and Girl Club corporation in the nation. And I had raised tons of money. And the James Jordan Boys and Girls Club, after Michael Jordan, dad, was my biggest success. I told Michael and his family and his mom, sisters and brothers, we raised millions of dollars. It just is a monument to my career in both philanthropy and in youth development. So that move to Chicago sealed my career in many, many ways. I made more money in Chicago than I couldn't have made in Columbus. I was surprised at my paycheck and was able to move to a decent apartment. You know, but I was able to trend more. And so that side of me became a lot more culturized, if you know what I'm saying. Because you had more income, I was introduced to the income earning community that could introduce me then to galleries and art. And I joined a group called Urban Gateways in Chicago, which was known as a group of African Americans that were studying art and following collectors. Because at the time, collections were just beginning to come into vogue. And so we would visit homes and analyze art and talk to the owner of these art collections. I got to meet powerful, powerful leaders in that regard, very wealthy philanthropists. And the discipline of being in that audience, of learning how to ask and to talk and to present myself in an audience of wealthy people, became part of it. And I remember Renee Crown, an incredible philanthropist in our city, Lester and Renee Crown, said to me, Carl Lavender, if you want to be a good fundraiser, continue to be a popular dinner guest. That's where many things are pitched. Now, pillow talk, people close the deal. But dinner guests around the table, can you talk about what you want to do? That was Chicago for me. Second to none, it was a powerful journey.
So there's some interesting juxtaposition in your development there, because on one hand, you're going rougher, right? You're going to places that were more dangerous and more intense in that direction, but then you're also going into the upper crust crowd, and you know, and that's intense. Neither of these were, you know, you had access to as much in Columbus, right? Yeah. So how did that feel? I mean, I'm assuming the rougher part came first, right? Because you just got thrown into that. So let's start there. And, you know, what do you remember about, you know, was it fear? Was it, you know, what do you remember?
Chicago West Side. Yes, there's a little bit of fear. All right. I mean, this was very, very serious. I mean, I was on the corner of Washington and Sacramento. In your audience right now, folks know Chicago, you know where that is. So yes, but I had to do a job, Joe. I had to do a job. Remembering my father and my mother, you have a job to do. You chose this space, do your job. But on the other hand, I also thought, okay, is this the evolution of my professional career? That is, I watched the development office in the Chicago organization, those who are raising the money, their life was very different than mine in the community. I thought to myself, that's interesting. I wouldn't mind being in the downtown office. on Jackson Street at the time and have a suite of offices. They were in a corporate high rise. And I thought to myself, I could do that. Let me try. So in that regard, the work that intensified on the West Side, I also began to develop this sense of presentation and how can I take on assignment. I volunteered for a lot of projects in the development office, the fundraisers, et cetera. I'll help out. I'll work the event. I will be at the door. I'll do whatever I have to do to get into the development team. And so they begin to call upon me. You know, we want someone from the community clubs to speak to an audience of whatever, whatever, at a luncheon or a tea. And I would get called. Carl can do this. And it became a part of my, I got more and more comfortable in that regard. And thus I got moved out of the club into the corporate office, and the rest is history.
So I could call that operating, right? In a good way. You know, I love people who are great operators. And to me, that's just seeing opportunity, mm-hmm. connecting two dots. Seems like your dad did that. He was a hub for opportunity and he operated, right? And here you're making a point. You're intentionally going to volunteer in these places you wanted to be. You know, you had the awareness to be a good dinner guest. So you're operating. Do you take, is that a fair term? And do you take
pleasure? I think so. You know, I was sharing with some people the other day on a call. The great Loretta Caldwell Thompson in our city organized this call with Urban League America Guilds, and I was a guest speaker. And I said to people, it's very clear to me that you are your first business. Mm. You're the president and CEO of your name. And so how you invest in yourself, how you're growing yourself, how are you developing yourself, the dividends you pay yourself. I mean, all of that is an important part of your own logic model, if you will, regarding who you are as a person. So absolutely the lessons were learned, if I follow your thread. But yeah, absolutely.
And great operation benefits the other folks as much as it benefits you, right? That's when the really good ones.
Well, you discover your gifts.
Yeah.
Okay, you discover your gifts. And if you are not in that process of discovering your gifts, I encourage your audience to do so. So what are the gifts that you can bring into operation? You don't bury your gifts under the table, under a bushel, as scripture says, and let only your one candle light. You have to invest in yourself and make sure that others are benefiting from that.
So let's talk a little bit about the Jordan Center. What an incredible opportunity. How did that start? And just walk us through.
Well, Michael Jordan's father died tragically. As you all know, the national story. And there was many ways there was national mourning. But in Chicago, it was particular mourning because people didn't realize that Mr. Jordan was a big part of the Bulls' journey. He was a locker room dad. He traveled with the team. He was very close to Michael. They talked all the time. And he was just a big part of our city. And so when that happened, it was a great tragedy. As losing your father anywhere in the world should be or would be. And so to that end, the response came back from the Bulls camp. What can we do to honor the legacy of James Jordan? And the James Jordan Boys and Girls Club came to be as part of that conversation. Our national office had been courting Michael for a major gift, but he wasn't returning calls. And I can brag about that a little bit because he returned my call. But at the end of the day, they were trying to get connected to his philanthropy because he hadn't demonstrated it yet. And so this process, he revealed his first ever major gift to the world. He made a gift to us and a gift to the University of North Carolina. But he had not been doing much of that prior to that. So I'm very proud that that moment was his own journey. And I got to talk to him quite a bit during that time. Then at some point, you know how life is with celebrity. When they're on the cusp of Phoenix status, where they transcend all logic, he disappeared. So those calls were stopped and there were gatekeepers. But I'm just glad that in a season, I had Michael Jordan talking to me about clothes. If you can believe that, talking about life and family. And his sister was a spoken word artist. And it was a brief moment that I will never forget, that I will always cherish. I got to know his mom very, very well and work with him on a couple of projects. And so, but then not long after that happened, I mean, literally, you know, his whole life took off into a massive, massive American or global iconic status, a billionaire now in so many ways. But I'm just very, very pleased, Joe, that I was there for that little brief moment.
Why do you think he hadn't? Why hadn't he pulled?
I don't think that many of the players at that time, their contracts and the cash flow that went along with it didn't always provide for the kind of major gifts that we in charities need to have. But when the endorsements came along and they could then play in the contract, but also have endorsements, well, now my cash flow is very different. And I could begin to be a whole lot more strategic. And I think since that time, Michael was a pioneer in that regard of the major gift side. I'm sure players were doing small gifts to charities and their local, but making major gifts of multi-million dollars, Michael was the first to really emerge with that kind of thing. And so I'm just very, very pleased that of that episode in my life. Very pleased.
Wonderful. All right, so let's get into St. Pete's Boys and Girls Club. Talk about the journey from Chicago and that ultimately ended in St. Pete.
You know, it's a corporate journey. So I was the senior vice president for the Boys and Girls Club of Chicago. The club had a president and CEO who I knew very, very well, young, dynamic family. And I had come to the place where I said, okay, I'm SVP. I've accomplished these things, Jordan Club, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now what happens? I want to be a president and CEO. And the word from the president's office was, not this job. You can be a president, but not, I'm going to be here for a while. I get it. So I called national staff and I said, listen, I want out. I said, what? Aren't you going to stay hanging around? I said, no, I really need to be a president and CEO before my window closes where it won't be as relevant professionally. So I got to interview here for the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Sun Coast, headquartered in Kansas City. I didn't know about Kansas City at the time, but interview, got picked and relocated here back in 1999. Oh my goodness. And came down to become a president and CEO. I needed to have that journey on my resume if I was to be at some point a consultant or a senior leader or whatever. I needed to have the executive journey of a nonprofit on my resume. I took the job. Sight unseen, Joe. Sight unseen. Never been here before. Flew out for the interviews, got hired, packed up my things, left Chicago and moved to 4th and Gandy in St. Petersburg when it was just being developed, and just sat there and went, okay, and rolled around. I said, oh my goodness, where am I at here? It was a very different journey for me coming out of a progressive city in so many ways like Chicago to one where there was lots of familiar faces to each other. I had at the time had a certain charisma and dynamic as an African American that presented itself like corporate life, which I did in Chicago. I went to several meetings here like Rotary, et cetera, and a shirt and tie and the whole picture. And I was told one day by a Rotarian, you're dressing as if you're running the place. Take the tie off, man. Get to know us better kind of thing. And that was cultural, if you will, trying to get used to it. So, yes, came down, ran the Boys and Girls Club Suncoast for 10 years and then retired from there.
So a shock from Chicago, but somewhat familiar from Columbus.
That's a good observation. Yes, back to the Midwest roots, the I-75 corridor. Yes, back to that kind of thing. And so it was a return to a little bit more simpler life in that regard. And I had to really re-engineer my thinking in order to raise money because the organization was struggling for capital. I mean, really struggling. Mm-hmm. Lessons learned in anybody taking over a nonprofit organization, ask for the balance sheet. Ask how many months of payroll do you have in reserves? I mean, when people hire sometimes, these boards will hire someone to rescue them or to have someone to blame because the whole thing is going under. And I ended up in a scenario where there were significant challenges in fundraising and called me to task in so many ways to pull it off.
So how, you know, we talked about operating and we talked about the access you had in Chicago. A lot of that changes gears here from just straight being new,
sure,
but also those people just not being here. And then, you know, the operating scales down equivalently as well. So, I mean, did you suffer with that at all?
It was moments when I thought, I'm going home. I mean, really, it was moments when I thought, okay, this is not going to work for me. I'm not finding my tribe. I don't mean by race and gender. I'm just mean a tribe of people who think progressively about ideas. Everybody seemed rather complacent.
Mm-hmm.
And satisfied. And I was told by some people, well, this is the beach and the sand. And what are you talking about? Big ideas. And you know, people like, for example, in Chicago, we opened our clubs on Saturdays. And I got here, we don't open on Saturdays. Why? Because everybody's home on Saturday with their families. Well, in Chicago, that was a big day, packed Saturdays, all kind of things to keep kids off the street. We close our clubs at 6 o'clock p.m. in Suncoast. What? We close at 10 o'clock in Chicago. So it was that kind of adaptation. And then the major gifts wasn't one. People were given $150, $250. I said, what is this? Gifts of $150 from board members, $500, $800. I had never seen the kind of numbers before. I said, no, you can't exist with those kind of. So it was challenging the board to jump from a 500 to a 5,000. So organizing the board into who has that kind of money was quite an exercise because people hadn't had that before. But I had to do that. You have to put people together. Those who had make major gifts, pull them together, have a conversation. So again, it was in some ways a maverick play because I said, you can't exist on these small gifts, people, and allow us to raise them United Way and JBB and others. No, you have to give money.
So did you find any solace in, you know, the fact that you were, like you said, you showed up as big city corporate and there weren't counterparts to that? You know, then you start to introduce the sort of big fish, small pond kind of thing where, you know, you can be successful because you don't have, there's not as many sharks swimming around, you know, trying to do the same thing. So did that give you solace?
Well, I tell you, it attracted the curiosity seekers for sure. Now we're hearing about this guy with these big ticket ideas and big ideas and flowing everywhere. So it attracted some folks who were curious. Rick Baker was one. And I have to give him credit because he became my champion. Once he listened to me that I wasn't just a sharp suit, empty suit, making a pitch kind of thing, that I was very sincere about this work being well resourced and ideas of growing the brand. He became my champion, and as did Go Davis. The two of them became very much in favor of me. And the third person was Gwen Reese. We oftentimes debate, because Mother Reese can be fierce in that regard. This ain't Chicago, and I get it. But, I mean, we became very, very, very dear friends because she understood it. Then she brought in Gypsy Gallardo and Lewis Murphy. And so there were a lot of people that began to say, okay, fine. Then I began to say, folks, let's do some more. Let's do some other kind of things that we can try. And not that I take full credit for it, but I've seen some progress, some bigger ticket items, which led to many things I've done in my career here in St. Petersburg.
So did Mary Baker become a long-term ally then? In that?
Oh, my goodness. All of us, and Joe, I know you know this also, you all come to that pivot moment in your career. It's either going to go left or it's going to go right. And Mary Baker and Joyce, his lovely wife, were able to help me to steer toward my long-term stay. I know I would not be here today had it not been. He was a blessing to me. It was a very clear message. You're going to be here for a while. So introducing me to people, Bill Edwards was one, who was our first big investor in the Royal Theater. The numbers Bill Edwards shared on in the media were big numbers. People hadn't had these numbers before in the youth organizations. They had in museums and hospitals and universities. People are like, whoa, how do you raise, $350,000 from who? Who's Bill Edwards? And who's this guy, Carl Lavender? What's going on with the Royal Theater? It became a buzz. And I thank Rick Baker to this day. Really, I do.
It's wonderful. And I want to talk, you know, you've mentioned a few times, and even before we started recording, I'm going to ask you to remember the line about if you advertise, we were talking about Lehman and advancing Lehman, and you talked about the optics, you know, the more ribbon cuttings we have, the more, you know, people can understand what this place is. Do you remember you used a line about you have to advertise to something?
Trying to remember myself, my friend, you know, but Lehman knowing the market, realizing the market, there are more ribbon cuttings to have. And so it's an important part of this.
Yeah. And so, you know, you talk being a good dinner guest, but brand, you know, basically yes, what it comes down to is that people, you know, have a familiarity with brand. It gives them a consistent landing spot for their brain to hit when they start to say over and over and over again, this is a brand. Mm-hmm. I love brand because to me, it's free value. It's additive value, right? It doesn't take anything from anybody. You know, I always use the example of our beach tribe versus like a South Beach in Miami. You know, in South Beach in Miami, somebody from Peoria, Illinois is going to go there. They're posting about it on social in advance. I'm going to South Beach. I'm going to have this meal at this restaurant by this chef and this drink. And I'm going to have this view and walk along and see these kind of cars and this kind of deco. Then they take pictures of it. They post it. At the end of the day, it's a steak by the water, right?
Right.
Yeah, but it's all much more than that to them, right? And so the more of that you can bring into things from a fundraising standpoint, from a quality of life standpoint, you know, just from it just builds value. And it seems like that I feel like you've mentioned that a few times and as being an important piece of the puzzle.
Absolutely. If we cannot bring value or values, because the value equation on the balance sheet is an important conversation, but that is followed by or accompanied by your own personal values, so that whatever you're doing on the balance sheet side isn't driven by blind ambition or selfish ambition, because there are those who would do that. There are those who would follow it as very, very selfish ambition on the balance sheet side. That's that maverick temperament that says, I'll step on anybody to get to what I want. And certainly in commerce around the world, that personality may very well thrive. But it's a shelf life personality, because eventually someone will challenge it and dismiss it. That's why your values perspective is what matters the most. That is, you believe in people and the capacity and the potential of people and systems to change when change is necessary. And those of us who are change agents, that's our role. It's our gift to these situations to say, allow me to share with you what I see. Most times there's so much traffic in systems, no one is listening to that. But with those who do, you begin to say, all right, fine, there's potential here to change some things. Here's some ideas. Let's go to the whiteboard.
So after Boys and Girls Club, you had went education with PTEC?
Yes, Boys and Girls Club. After Boys and Girls Clubs, I went to the Pinellas Education Foundation under Terry Bang. And there was a grant that Terry had received from the Ford Foundation, Next Generation Learning. And he had hired a person to manage the grant side in Pinellas County, but that person moved to Boston within weeks of the grant being announced. So he called me on my cell. I'll never forget it. I'm retired from the Boys and Girls Clubs. I'm on the beach, what I said I was going to do, which I do all the time, by the way. Sitting there, and my phone rings. It's Terry Bain. Terry, how's it going? Carl, I got this job. You know, Terry, very blunt. Do it right now. Come right now to the office. I literally go in shorts and flip-flops, and we're talking on the phone, talking in his office. And I said, fine, I'm ready to rock and roll. So I became his consultant, and I was there for 18 months. So the career academies and all of the high schools, I was on the team to bring those to life. Phenomenal story in my career pathway. Dave Barnes, who oversaw the division before Mark Hunt, took a lot of credit in my life and gave me lots of opportunities to grow and talk to principals. That's how I got to know everybody, including Julie Mastery. I got to go around all the schools and talk about career academies and the value of technical industries, et cetera. It was an incredible, once again, blessed that I am to have this job to go around the schools and talk. And this number is just soared. Very, 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 very well received. When the grant ran out, you know, Terry, the grant's over, so therefore the job is too. I said, what am I going to do? Got a call from Dave Barge saying, listen, the marketing person at PTEC has just left, moved to California. I love your style. I like how you do, and you get results. Take the job. So I took it. Part time. Because Dave watching his numbers. It was part time, then more hours, then more hours, then more hours. Dave leaves. Mark Hunt comes in. I become full time. Mark gives me both the Clearwater and St. Pete campuses. Boost the salary. I'm in front of Grego, in front of the school board, in front of the, so it's growing. They're listening to my pitch. They're understanding Mr. Carl believes in this thing. And then I got a call from Randy Russell.
Mm-hmm.
I had talked to an audience of folks in philanthropy and industry around allied health as career pathways out of the CRA. And Randy was in the audience and called me afterwards saying, I was really moved by your presentation. It made a lot of sense. We're interested in funding these kind of things, but I need you to come on my team to do so. I said, right now, I'm loving where I am, Randy. Call me in a year. And he did. Almost to the day. He called me in a year. His person had left, who was there, Curtis Holloran. He had left, and Randy offered me the job. So I left PTEC and went to the foundation. I was there under Randy Russell for 4.5 years, then interim CEO for a year or so with Carol Martin Brown, great person. And that's that story. And I loved that job because it was the combination. Those of us in nonprofit work, you know, we always dream of, I want to be a funder. If I were a funder, I'd give more money. If I were a funder, I'd understand. So I went to the beach one day. It was like, oh, no, three in the morning. I said, God, you know, I got this call from this guy, Randy Russell. I wouldn't mind being on staff. And I took it and changed some things. We modified some things. It's a great team in place. And that is in that Center for Health Equity, being a part of that, Joe, bringing that to life. That's all part of a Mr. Carl Lavender being a change agent inside any community.
So talk about that, coming from so many years of asking for money to being the person giving the money. What would you tell the people asking for money?
Three things. Mm-hmm. Be prepared. Be prepared. Be prepared. Do not be presumptuous. I mean, I have folk calling me now that, now that you're there, my name is whatever, whatever, and I live on so-and-so community, and can you give us some money to help some kids? No, I cannot. I mean, I thought you was dying. I thought you was, it was that kind of response in the beginning. It tapered off after a while, but you learn how to instruct people on how to ask for dollars, how to pitch the brand, how to show data, how to research for data, building your boards out, looking at your audits or compilations. All of that became a big part of that journey. And so I learned a lot being in that role, because I am a generous person by nature. And so I want to just give it, because I got to get it. I want to give it. And yet processes are important. Outcomes are important. I learned a lot from Julie Rocco, who's on that team over there, who reported to me for a season. And I learned a lot from Randy, as a matter of fact, in terms of what this all looked like. So grateful for everybody that came into my life during that season. But here's the thing. I mean, to end up being an interim president and CEO of a new foundation, it was a pretty doggone good gig. So Carol Martin Brown and I ran the place after Randy had left. And so I have that now on my resume, that in fact, I was once the president and CEO of an emerging foundation. And I opened the Center for Health Equity and hired Marcus Brooks. So, I mean, so I'm very, all of my hires are over there.
Yeah, he's great. So then going back to prepared, how much of it is, I mean, obviously the cause has to fit with the specific thing you're trying to, if we were to say it bluntly, is it there are 20 people that come that all have equally good causes in different ways? It's actually the most apt operators and people who run the business the best that get the money, not the cause?
It's an interesting dichotomy. So grant making, if it is based on an RFP, then you're being very specifically aligned with RFP criteria is what will get you to a victory. Usually scored by points, you do well. The other side of philanthropy that is non-RFP is the more flexible pot of money, where in effect the president and the board could decide on a grant to a purpose outside of an RFP. There, you don't have to be as prescriptive. In that regard, being in front of them with your pitch, if you will, is incredibly an important moment to be created on your behalf. RFPs, very different. You fill it out online, you submit the data, you press send, it's now in the hands of the reviewers, and you don't have a chance necessarily to have a panel review your passion. I like connecting to passion. I like debating and defending and discussing an idea around the table and determining that we should fund it. And then, as a matter of fact, they ask for X, let's give them Y. And that Y extra, we can scale some part of the presentation even higher. That's one of the real advantages of philanthropy. You may come in and you're saying, this is what I need. We're on the other side of the table. We know how much money is available. We also know what we're thinking about doing based upon research. You may not know that necessarily. So having someone leave the room and we talk about it. I like the way they said this. I like the way they said that. This looks good. Tell you what, if we give the money, let's take this little piece here and scale that even more, because that piece of data may satisfy an RFP that is coming out in 2 years. You follow me? So it's all of those connections that happen when you're part of the fund making team.
And how much, we have 10,000 nonprofits in Pinellas, I think technically or something like that. It's an insane number. And there's lots of calls for consolidation and things like that. So how much did you feel the pressure to, or did you have an interest in sort of environment sculpting to say, we've got so many people and we don't need a Chihuahua rescues, right? And it's like,
yeah, 10,000 incorporated nonprofits, about 3,000 that are fully active that have a portfolio. I think
still a big number.
Yeah, still a big number. It's for the capacity and sustainability. It's a huge number. And so, yes, you ask for my own politic in this regard. I think it's time for some reform here. That's just me, folks. Don't get mad at me. But I mean, it's just time for some reform. But there are some things that don't require new funding for new nonprofits. I am one who is very concerned that over time, we've got all this nonprofit footprint. They won't be able to sustain their administrations. I like the Boys and Girls Club of Tampa Bay model, the sort of merged corporations, multiple counties under one administration. And if there is a youth development issue in the community, you can refer that to this corporation. I can't tell you how many people would call me to say, we got a gang war going on in South St. Pete over in Childs Park. And I would go out and I would say, have you talked to the following organizations that are already funded to serve in your community and to prevent crime? No, we haven't. Well, I would prefer you go there first or convene them to say, what are the gaps we can fulfill as a grant maker? Because a lot of people want to use it as a chance to raise their own payroll and raise their own resumes. And that I think we in philanthropy and any funders need to be aware of that, not cynical about it, but certainly aware that there are some people who would use the moment to A, build their resume for their own political future, or B, to raise their own payroll because they can't find a job nowhere else. So I'll come to the table to say, hey, I'm a youth leader. I'm a youth leader. So therefore fund my organization. It's bigger than that. So I think that it's time for some real alignment here with corporations that can manage a lot of. I love this group called the Hypatia model in our city under Amy Foster. This where boards of directors need to be convinced. You cannot keep looking for a charismatic leader to come in and rescue your balance sheet. Be smart. Outsource some of this kind of work. Must there be 3,000 separate administrations? No, no. I think you can get away with a lot less and then the demand. In that regard, yes, I would agree that there's too many.
And I see a similar outcome with different motivations when people are emotionally driven. You know, someone passed away from breast cancer or they love the Chihuahuas, right? They're getting an emotional benefit from starting this thing that sort of it gets diminished if they try to bolt it onto somebody else's thing, right? Because now they're not free to just be driven in any direction the emotion takes them. And so, you know, with that, it ultimately ends up in the same thing, one more nonprofit.
But those things in memory of,
yeah,
very different than those people.
Some
who
get pretty active though, and they actually actively raise over time for scholarships. But
gotcha, very different than one who is fully operational in community-based work,
right,
to do some change, if you will, regarding a data set. So that, but the in memory of, yeah, people. Those will happen even more if we boomers transition.
Right.
Because see, even I'm referring to the administrations that have been fully incorporated to deliver a service at the end of the day.
So what's the reform then?
The reform is very well done. In my mind.
Yeah, I mean, what would
suggest? A couple of things. I think that I would love to see the IRS put a moratorium on nonprofit corporation status and approvals in the next 10 years. I think we have enough nonprofit.
Kind of like a liquor license. There's a maximum.
I think there is enough infrastructure right now to satisfy any emerging need, even that in crisis, like storms. There's enough that is woefully lacking in proper support. You know, you need layer on that more nonprofits also demanding capital to sustain themselves. I just think it's time for that level of reform. Secondarily, boards of directors. Remember, the board of directors is the corporation, not the CEO and the C-suite. The board of directors is the corporation. So boards of directors that begin to think more strategically and not necessarily politically. That is, if I'm on the board, I want my agency to survive with the most money and be the most powerful in this, may not be the best pathway for you. Please add onto the board. Folk who will ask much more in-depth questions regarding your balance sheet. Number three is retiring CEOs. I mean, it's time. There are some CEOs that are still hanging on. Part of that because our 401ks have been so weak over time because our wages and salaries have not been very good. And so you want to hold on until you get enough capital to say, it's fine, I can go on and leave here and I don't have to struggle anymore. But at the end of the day, board of directors, you know your leader. And you know that it is time to sit down and have a very serious conversation. You keep them going year after year after year. If your board meeting is all filled with sentiment or tension, it's time. It's in that regard, it's time for some reform.
And do you feel that there is a next generation coming up to take their place? There's been a lot of talk about, you know, the Bill Edwards of the world and Tom James of the world aging out and there not being replacements.
I think the modern generation that are making dollars out of their portfolios, the Google industry, founders of small tech companies, et cetera. Yes. I don't think you're going to get from those guys these massive amounts of capital to fund so many administrations. I think this new generation is going to begin asking the question, why are there so many? Because a lot of those things, that question may be answered through AI systems. So this thing that all these nonprofits are all reporting to the one funding source, all that they're doing, you get reams and reams and reams and reams of data and information can all be consolidated in some cases. Or I think the driver for that will be the new philanthropic leaders who will ask the question, so why are there so many? I think the new leaders are also more inclined to incorporate meetings with multiple and competitive competition, because they're not thinking necessarily regarding the power footprint that we boomers can oftentimes. I think they're thinking about, okay, fine, let's reach across the aisle here. Let's talk to the Boy Scouts and the Boys and Girls Club and Junior Achievement. And why can't we all be in the same room at the same time discussing some adaptation to making things a little bit more efficient and streamlined and less costly kind of thing? So I think you'll see that more in this generation. I hope.
Wonderful. And then let's move on next to Chief Equity Officer, Interim Chief Equity Officer, then Chief Equity Officer at the city. How did that come about?
Well, you know, I've known the Welches for many, many years. Mayor's dad greeted me so many, many years ago when I first arrived here from Chicago. And I had saw him at a meeting. I can't recall what it was. He said, you got to come and see me. So I went to see him there on 16th. And the first thing he said to me when I sat down was, what are you doing here, Chicago? Why are you coming from Chicago? You know where you're at, kind of thing. I said, yes, sir, I do. I want to really want to be here. He wanted to hear me be sincere. I think he had heard some things. And I made my case. And he said, let me tell you something. I am not pleased with the Boys and Girls Clubs here on 22nd Street South. Looks like a dump. They're not doing too good. He had a few other expletives. I'll never forget. He said, I hope you're going to change that. Yes, sir, absolutely. I'm going to change that. I need your support. He said, when you need me. And we got to be really good friends. He and I were the ones instrumental with Mayor Baker in opening up the Johnny Ruth Clark Health Center on 22nd Street South. And I chaired the search committee to hire Pat Mabe, who was the first director of the remodeled campus. So he and I worked closely on that. So I have a lot of respect for him. Fast forward. Ken has been my champion behind the scenes in many places. And so when I stepped up from the foundation, he called me to say, I had this position. And I said, not really, not right now. I need some room past the, because Randy Russell, that whole chapter was very difficult. Give me some time here. And so he hired someone else. And when that didn't work out, he called me. I said, Mayor, I'm ready to rock and roll. So I came on staff and I was there for 15 months, but it was the perfect storm. I came on in the midst of the gas plant renegotiation and then three storm back to back and then the presidential election. So I felt sometimes that I was like in a bubble trying to figure out how to be seen. And we had some successes that I'm very, very proud of. But George Smith, who now has the JIT, will carry it even further. But for me, once again, if you follow my pattern in this conversation, once again, here I am. I'm opening the city's first equity office. I'm giving it full-time status. Lanise had turned the key, but I turned the future. And so I'm there, and I set it on the right pathway, and the rest is history, if it continues. We'll see what happens. But I mean, so I'm very proud of that. And I hope Mayor feels the same way. I don't know.
And do you think being a multi-generational African-American family here and the first Black mayor, how much pressure, expectations, can you talk about that Mayor Welch has had to handle?
Yeah, I don't know his mindset or point of view in that regard, but I'm sure there are expectations for legacy. His father was very successful here. The name is very strong in the Black community. I'm sure he has asked himself the question, so what is my legacy going to be? There's pressure in that regard. St. Petersburg has a cadre of Black leaders that are very much watching City Hall. And I think a little obsessive sometime. We watch City Hall so much here, we're not watching corporate life. We're watching City Hall all the time. And there are corporate leaders in our city, in our Bay Area, that ought to be more interested in the south side of St. Petersburg and not just government. I think government has capacity. And so, but nevertheless, I think that he has that both loyalties from childhood and the new loyalties from the emerging people that are moving here, that are asking the question, so what is happening in our community? So yes, I think there's some pressure there to fulfill that. He's quite capable and competent, but there is a lot of pressure here. I watched it during the storm. It was like watching a movie, how they had to navigate that to save lives. I tell you something, and I mean this lovingly, that if Mayor Kenneth Welch was Berry Gordy, then Claude Tankersley, Mike Jeffries, and Amy Foster are the Supremes. I mean, those three people are phenomenal professionals. They don't get nearly the credit that they deserve. I'm reading now there are some awards coming in. Good. I'm glad. Because if ever there were three people who were a phenomenal contribution to this administration, it's those three. Bar none. I mean, I was in awe. Every time we had meetings and I would hear them talk, I was in awe. Phenomenal trio. Phenomenal.
So I guess we'll finish up by doing the magic wand question. So, you know, you've worked in community impact from pretty much every angle there is. You've worked in education. You've worked in, you know, on the ground and providing service. You've worked in government. You worked on the funding side of it.
I'm hired. You going to hire me?
Maybe. What would you like to see? What's the lowest hanging fruit that you just are surprised it hasn't been fixed yet? Or, you know, it's something, what would the magic wand do?
I tell you, the magic wand for me would be, I am right now very, very impressed with two opportunities that have come to our city. The first is Foot Locker. Now, you look at their NASDAQ report, they're a business in transition in so many ways, but they're now headquartered in our city. And there's the potential to do a whole lot more with that. And so if I were mayor or I was head of economic development, I would ask the question, what more can Foot Locker do as a brand footprint in our city? That is a brand that is a brokered brand. In other words, they don't produce the shoe, they sell the shoe. And so who sells the shoes? Sales team members, customer service. Customer service is a massive career footprint for a brand like Foot Locker. So should we not have a customer service institute in South St. Petersburg to train people how to work or be hired? Should there not be a store inside? I remember Rob Gerdes had said it before, phenomenal. He said, let's get Foot Locker to open up a store on 22nd Street. I mean, if that's going to be their footprint, I think they may be more online going forward. But I mean, Foot Locker is a success story to be leveraged. Let's do our best to make sure they don't just have a headquarters here, that they have a headquarters in our city. And the next thing is 3D. I'm hearing this. We are now home to the largest 3D manufacturing company in the world in our city. So what does that mean for workforce? What does that mean for workforce development? And how might government step up to say, let's create a 5-year pathway and collaboration between St. Pete College, P-TECH, Eckerd College, and USF to create a 5-year academy on working in that space? Data scientists, programmers. You've got two great programming organizations in our city, CodeBox and CodeWiz. Bring them to the table. You cannot have the largest 3D printing company without having a 5-year journey on how to create workforce there. And so they need to be tied to the Science Center. I mean, there's just lots that can happen. So I'm very proud of that. So my wand would say, how can we take those things and turn them into more than a headline, but an actual footprint in our city?
So that's interesting. I mean, that's an interesting observation. Of all the places you could have gone, economic development, getting people jobs is the thing that came to top of mind, which I think.
Absolutely. I think that at this point, it's really time to leverage moments when we can dig deeper into economic development it's the great equalizer right now, folk. Come on. Equity is a balance sheet conversation, Joe. It really is. For those of us who've leveraged our equity in our mortgages to lease, if you've got equity, you've got capital, you can do a lot. Without it, you're going to struggle. And that's what I'm saying equity is all about. It's all about economic development. When I took the job at City Hall, I said to Doyle and Mayor, the Office of Equity should be in the Economic Development Division because that's where it is coming to life there, man. So having George in there now is a smart move on their part.
Then the old adage that the preferred choice to solve the affordable housing problems is lots of high-paying jobs so people don't need affordable housing.
Absolutely. And when you look at the dashboard that Amy Foster can produce, oh my goodness gracious, it's a terrific dashboard. So there'll be cynics and critics about all that, but there is a terrific dashboard to be shared regarding what Amy Foster has led on behalf of citizens from all walks of life in our city. It's a phenomenal accomplishment.
Wonderful. Well, I've enjoyed the conversation. We covered a lot of ground.
Thank you, Joe. I hope I did okay.
You did great. You didn't go Maverick on me, so I feel relieved.
I could have. No, just kidding. Yeah. It's good to see you from the day I met you at P-TECH.
That's right. I was just remembering with Jim Oresti.
Yes, exactly. How is Jim?
He's great. I think he's in Mexico right now.
All right. Good for him.
Yeah, living on the beach.
Living on the beach. There it is. If you've got it, do it. You know, it's wonderful. Please give him my regards.
I will.
Thank you, Joe, for having me.
Thank you, Carl Lavender.
My pleasure.